This is Grant Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Ambassador Dori Gold, former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and the author, most recently, of The Rise of Nuclear Iran, How Tehran Defies the West. And Mr. Ambassador, it's great to have you with us.
It's good to be with you and the listeners.
We have heard that time is of the essence when it comes to Iran and its nuclear ambitions. Our own former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, who I'm sure you know well, has said that Israel may need to decide by the end of the year what its policy is going to be, whether military will be an option and so forth. We'll talk about the military option in a moment, but how short is the window of opportunity to do something about Iran's nuclear ambitions, do you think?
Well, frankly, we just have to look at the hard data that the International Atomic Energy Agency releases. Now, the IAEA, as it's called in the acronym, the UN watchdog, is not known for being an alarmist organization. In fact, if anything, it has protected Iran when you look at the conclusions of its outgoing director, Mohammed El-Baradei. But the data it puts forward is very useful for people to see. I mean, Iran, if you go back to November 2008, the time of your last U.S. elections, had already enriched roughly 839 kilograms of low-enriched uranium. Today, that quantity is up to 1,500 kilograms. It's almost doubled. And they are already at the point where if they take that stock of low-enriched uranium that we all know about and put it through the centrifuges in Natanz just one more time, they would have enough for two atomic bombs. And that's at present. That's just a decision they have to take. But in terms of the technology and the quantities of uranium they have, they are ready to cross the nuclear threshold.
From what you know of the Iranian regime and how they've conducted themselves in the past, is this a regime that's more likely to hang on to them and try to bully Israel and other countries that they don't like, or would they try to deploy them, you think, as quickly as possible?
Well, first of all, this is a regime under siege, under an internal siege by people who are thirsty for freedom. And we saw that after the June 12th presidential elections in Iran. Those demonstrators were facing not just riot police, but the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. And they were brave and they were determined to obtain their freedom. Now, Iran historically, when it is under an internal siege of that sort, when it has internal instability, it has historically looked to external adventurism in order to distract attention from the internal problems. So I would anticipate that Iran in the months and period ahead would seek to become far more aggressive in its international behavior, whether towards Israel or towards the United States.
What else might that include other than obviously deploying extremely dangerous weapons?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that Iran is the number one supporter of terrorism in the world today. You look at all the states that are out there supporting international terrorism, all the historical backers of international terrorism, Libya, Syria. Iran is number one, and that's basically what the U.S. Department of State says. So you take a state which has been exporting terrorism, and you give that state nuclear weapons capability, the possibilities for activity are extremely widespread. By the way, Iran today is no longer just a power affecting the security of the Middle East, threatening the Persian Gulf, threatening the Strait of Hormuz, where 40% of the West's oil travels. Iran, over the last number of years, has developed a huge presence in Latin America that very few people are noticing. They've opened about six embassies. They have a presence in Nicaragua. They have a huge presence with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Today, Hezbollah operatives that would normally be used for terrorist operations can go into Venezuela without a passport, without a visa, and they already are building up an infrastructure for operations in that country. In fact, by the way, just interesting, the Venezuelans allow the Iranians to bring proselytizers to spread Shiite Islam, and they are working on a large Indian tribe along the Venezuelan-Colombian border. So all this activity is occurring while everybody is sort of either asleep or distracted by other issues, but it certainly gives the Iranians a whole array of potential levers they can use for affecting the considerations of the United States or other countries that might come into conflict with Iran someday.
One of the critical points you make in this book, Ambassador Gold, is that diplomacy, at least certainly the style of diplomacy being employed right now by the West, is extremely ineffective and actually improves Iran's standing in this debate and makes them stronger with a stronger hand as they move forward with their nuclear program. Explain why that is and what course should change.
Well, in the very beginning of my book, The Rise of Nuclear Iran, I tell the story of Hassan Rouhani, who was chief nuclear negotiator for Iran back in the years 2003 and 2005. And in that period of time, engagement with Iran was tried. And it was tried by the European Union with the support of the United States. There were three countries in the EU that sent diplomats, sent their foreign ministers, the UK, Germany, and France. And Rouhani admitted when the negotiations were over that while he and his diplomats were talking to the West, Iran was telling its engineers at the Isfahan uranium conversion plant to work in double shifts so that they could complete their uranium conversion plant. Now, in the production of enriched uranium for nuclear weapons, the first phase is mining it and producing what's called yellow cake. Then you take the yellow cake to a conversion plant and you generate uranium hexafluoride gas, and then that gas goes to another facility at Natanz where it is enriched for weapons use eventually. Now, at that second stage at Isfahan was completed while the West was negotiating. And so the Iranians simply outmaneuvered completely the greatest diplomats that the West could put forward and completed a project. When they started the negotiations with the West in 2003, they had no facility at Isfahan. There was no conversion plant. It was almost a parking lot. And when they finished negotiations in 2005, the whole plant was up and running, and they converted 37 tons of yellow cake to produce this UF6, this uranium hexafluoride gas. So the Iranians are experts in strategic deception, in deceptive diplomacy. I explain that in my book, The Rise of Nuclear Iran, so people will understand what you're dealing with. You can't just say, oh, you know, let's go back to the negotiating table and, you know, we'll try and work this out and work out a win-win situation for both sides. That's how you think here in the West. That is not how they think on their side.
Absolutely incredible what you just told us. And I know you talk about it a lot more in the book because I think the conventional wisdom out there is that it's just been a stalemate. Progress hasn't been made, but plenty of progress has been made for the Iranians throughout this entire process. So if the diplomacy and the tact that we've taken so far hasn't worked and probably won't work, what would?
What has historically been shown to work with the Iranians are really two things. One, you're going to need extremely painful sanctions. And I know that in Congress, there are both Democrats and Republicans who've prepared legislation that will prevent the sale of gasoline to Iran. Ironically, Iran can drown in its own oil. It has plenty of crude oil, but it does not have enough refinery capacity to produce gasoline for the automobiles in Iran and trucks. So they have to import about 40% of their gasoline from abroad. Now, if you in the United States and in the European Union said to the Iranians, or excuse me, said more properly to the companies that are bringing that gasoline to Iran, you continue selling gasoline to Iran, you will not be able to trade with the United States or with a single European country. Then you dry out, you quarantine that country, you dry out their gasoline supplies. That is enormous leverage because we know that last time that the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, tried to put on some kind of quotas for gasoline, he had riots. So you've got a great lever which you can use in the future with Iran before you even talk about military options.
In terms of the counter effect to that, would it make any sense for Iran to then retaliate by cutting off our oil supply? Or does the fact that they need us to refine that oil and give them their gasoline make that an improbable reaction on their part?
They cannot cut off the sale of oil because most of the budget of the Iranian government comes from the sale of oil. So that would really be slicing their own throats in revenge.
Do we have enough time to implement such a strategy before they have deployable weapons that could clearly threaten Israel and other Western nations?
The time is a matter of months, but you got to start with something. And I think you can get a large consensus around that kind of program before you go to anything else.
Some have said that it's the U.S. that has to take the lead on this. I've seen recent polls that show less than 5% of Israelis think that this current administration is pro-Israel. Are you concerned about the tack that the Obama White House is taking, and what advice would you give them?
I don't want to give advice to the U.S. government of how what it should do. I'm describing in my book the rise of nuclear Iran. What are some of the ideas that are already out there in the public domain in the United States? And I'm critical of some. I praise others. But that's a decision you're going to have to take. Whether the Obama administration goes after Iran or not is not a question of whether it's pro-Israel or not. This is not just an Israeli issue.
Correct.
The first one in the firing line of Iran, in my judgment, is the Arab Kingdom of Bahrain, which has a Shiite majority, a Sunni minority government, and has had revolts in the past in the 1990s, which, according to intelligence reports, were triggered by Iranian action, by Iranian security services. So that is a more likely target than Israel. And if I was advising the government of Kuwait or the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia, that would be my number one priority, to stopping Iran. So you have Arab allies who are concerned about this at least as much as Israel.
And in terms of the Israeli people, I'm sure you have a good handle on that. How closely is the public following this? How worried are they that a terrorist organization could be slipped a nuke and it could be deployed there in a short period of time?
Well, there is something else that I think Israelis are concerned with. You have to understand the background of Israel, the history of Israel. Beside the threats to the Arab world, the leadership of Iran, both the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, have threatened to wipe Israel off the map.
Multiple
or another
times.
Expression, to wipe Israel off the pages of history. Whether you take expression one or expression two, that's a direct threat to the existence of the country I come from. And Iran is developing the capacity to do that. Now, you know, there have been a number of Western academics who say, well, he wasn't talking about wiping Israel physically off the map. He was saying that Israel, the regime in Israel, will fall apart, like the Soviet Union. It wasn't that Iran would take an active act. Well, it turns out that if you watch Iranian television, you can see military parades in which the Iranians themselves take those expressions, like wiping Israel off the pages of history, put it on a billboard, attach the billboard to a large tractor trailer that's carrying a Shihab-3 missile that can strike Israel. So it's the Iranians themselves in their military parades who suggest that there's a direct connection between their goal of wiping Israel off the map and the missiles and nuclear programs they're developing at the same time. So those academics have said that this is not a threat to Israel, simply ought to watch Iranian TV.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, you've articulated the threat not only to your own people, but the region and even the world as a result of Iran's radical ideology as well as their obviously burgeoning nuclear program. Thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Ambassador Dori Gold, former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. The book is The Rise of Nuclear Iran, How Tehran Defies the West. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.